I don't want to be in a gym or auditorium not actually doing anything. I don't see the point in it. And it's strange for me too, because usually I would wish I would not be doing anything in school, but actually I need to do something. I have a lot of energy and I need to actually use my energy to do something that will actually be beneficial for my future. And not to mention, I have teachers that teach me stuff that helps me get ready for college. Like, I've seen like college material that my teacher have taught me to help me further my education, but now I'm missing out on a lot of that stuff.
Fairfax High School senior Alicia Castillo this morning. It is the third day of the teacher's strike. More than 30,000 walked off the job. The union and the district have not met since last week. But the pressure to settle may increase as teachers go without a salary and the district loses funding because so many kids aren't in school. So far, the district has lost nearly $45 million. The teachers have lost about $30 million. Joining us now is Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of the union. Hi there.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, when do you expect to meet again with the other side?
Well, we were very frustrated last week when Austin Buettner had made a call for me and him to come to the table. He then didn't show up to two out of the three sessions that we had last week while I and my bargaining team were there. So we were frustrated, so we initiated conversations with the mayor about trying to pull us back together. And we expect to be meeting sometime soon.
Why didn't he show up?
You'd have to ask him. I know that on Friday he didn't show up because he was simultaneously doing a press conference, showing an offer that he was going to give us to the press before he showed it to us.
What is the mayor saying?
Well, the mayor's playing a productive role in trying to pull the parties together and schedule a session, and we believe that we'll meet soon.
But you have no date set?
That's getting worked out today.
Okay. Have you come up with any points with the mayor that you will bring to the board that would potentially end the strike? Some areas where you're willing to compromise?
Yeah, I mean, we get it that any sort of negotiation involves compromise. The things that we're not willing to compromise on are classes of 48 students in high schools and 39 in elementary schools. An escape clause for the district on class size where they can unilaterally break through class size caps whenever they want to. 80% of schools without full-time nurses, not enough counselors. Those are things that we are not willing to compromise on. There are a set of other things that, yeah, absolutely, we want to try to reach an agreement, and we'll go in with some flexibility on those items.
Okay, the number of students per classroom, that seems to be a point where the two sides disagree on the actual number. The district saying they're offering 39 students on average in high schools, 35 in middle schools. Is that not what you're seeing?
It's not the case. What they did is they offered what they're proposing to permanently raise class sizes in the contract, which would have up to 46 students in high school classes and up to 39 students in elementary school classes, which is unacceptable. And then they put a one-year offer across the table that they say would reduce class sizes to the numbers that you just mentioned. But it's unacceptable, number one, because permanent class sizes would be raised, and number two, because that's only a one-year thing. And our students don't need low class sizes for 1 year. They need it throughout their career.
Right. Okay, well, what about the toll that this is taking on teachers themselves? They're picketing without pay. They're losing, as I said, millions of dollars, and the district is losing millions of dollars, and therefore may have even less money to meet your demands.
We've been overwhelmed with the amount of support and energy out there. We've had, on Monday and Tuesday, we had almost 75,000 people out in downtown L.A., on Monday, you know, something close to that. On Tuesday, we've got 30,000 folks on picket lines, tens of thousands of parents on picket lines. So there's a ton of energy and enthusiasm out there because our folks know, and parents know, and youth know, that this is a fight for the soul of public education. So what really has hurt folks is a decade of neglect and a decade of saying that we should privatize schools by turning them over to privately run charters instead of funding them. So we're worried about the decade worth of impact, and if it takes a short time of some sacrifice in order to change that, then our members have said very clearly that we're willing to do that, and we've got a ton of support out there.
But are you worried that as this drags on, that support will wane? Parents will start getting frustrated that their kids aren't in school, may actually shop around to send their kids to charters or private schools because of it.
Well, the district could end this strike very quickly by coming to the table around our key demands and really making substantive offers. We were very encouraged last night by seeing the Loyola Marymount poll that showed over 80% of people in L.A. County supporting the teacher's strike and the demands of the teacher's strike. We've got four candidates for U.S. president, likely candidates for U.S. president in 2020 on the Democratic side, who have been very explicit in supporting the teacher's strike and our demands. We've got an increasing number of Hollywood folks coming out. This is the movement, frankly, that we've needed. We've neglected our public schools and chosen to privatize them instead of funding them. And this is the movement we've needed. So we're gonna keep on moving this, getting back to the table as well, obviously trying to resolve it quickly, but in the meantime, continuing to build this movement that's so important.
And if you reach a deal, it'll only be in effect for about 18 months, right? What happens after that?
Well, the term of the agreement is you know, that's determined by the parties, but typically it would be through June of 2020. And so, yeah, we would reach an agreement, and we would try to lay down as many things that would be ongoing and continuous that would support student learning as possible. And then we'd, you know, hopefully build some trust through this process to be able to come back to the table in a different way next time around.
All right. Alex Caputo-Pearl, president of UTLA, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
All right, let's hear from the district now. Joining us, Nick Melvoin, vice president of the LAUSD Board of Education. He's seen as part of the block of board members who support charter schools. Hi, Nick.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, when are you going to meet with the teachers union again?
I hope today. You know, we were disappointed when the teachers union walked away from the table on Friday. You know, I heard Alex speak about, you know, I think he ended talking about trust, and there's a lot of trust that needs to be built.
Well, he said Buettner stepped away. So
Superintendent Buettner and our board president were up in Sacramento meeting with legislators and with the governor's team, actually trying to find more money to put on the table, which we did in our proposal on Friday. I think there is definitely some mistrust and miscommunication, as you heard. Our negotiating team, of which the superintendent is not a member, just as Alex has not been a member of theirs, was meeting, and it was the union who walked away. We've been trying to get them back. We have not wanted a strike and its impact on kids and families. And so I'm hopeful to hear some of that language of compromise. And, you know, we are here and welcome them back to the table whenever they're ready.
Are you also speaking with Mayor Garcetti?
Yes, we have. And speaking to the mayor, speaking to the governor's team, I think trying to get folks to bring the parties back to the table, in this case, bring UTLA back, and see where else we can identify funds. I think there's a lot of agreement in some of the things I heard. I started, you know, Alex talked about 10 years of disinvestment. I started as a teacher 10 years ago in LA Unified. My classes were too large. I was laid off every year as a result of budget cuts. We are looking to put more money on the table. Yesterday, we secured $10 million from the County Board of Supervisors for nurses. We want this to be a state conversation when 90% of our money comes from Sacramento. I think that there needs to be a willingness to accept our financial reality. I, you know, heard him say that he's willing to compromise, but not on some key demands, which cost hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right. Well, let's talk about one of those, and that's the class sizes. There seems to be, as we discussed, some disagreement over what you're offering, what the union sees you offering. You say you're offering a reduction to 39 students in high schools, but that would only be for a year?
So class sizes across the board are too high, and actually we're the second lowest class size out of the top 10 largest districts in California, which just evinces that this is a state issue. Section 1.5 of the contract, which UTLA has agreed to for the last, I believe, 18 years, talks about this process by which, in times of financial distress, the district has to increase class sizes unless we were to close schools. We want to reduce class sizes. We want to work with the union to make sure there's more transparency and collaboration so teachers don't feel like at any given day.
Right, but what's the number?
So I think that's where we're trying to go to. We're trying to work at on the table or at the table with UTLA, especially as we think about how do we turn on one-time funds like our reserve into ongoing investments. I think we are looking at the numbers that are in that initial contract 20 years ago when the state actually had a line item for class size reduction and saying those days have changed, so let's agree on something that's more reasonable.
What do you think
is
acceptable? Just throw out some numbers for elementary, high school. What is reasonable? Do you think students can learn if there are 40 kids in a classroom?
I think it depends on the subject and the teacher. I mean, you know, from my teaching days and looking at research, the most effective, you know, way to increase achievement is the strength of the teacher in the classroom. I agree. And I think that, you know, even 25, 26 in an elementary classroom is too high. But it's a financial issue when the expense to the district of a teacher is $110,000. Now, that is inclusive of benefits and pension, but, it's a $100 million issue. So I look at some of the things that we're talking about, which are, you know, 27 and then TK through 3, 34 for grades 4 to 5. And I say those aren't ideal. But until we go from being the 44th out of 50 states in per student funding in California to near the top again, it's the best we're going to be able to do. And so that's why this conversation has to just be the starting point of how do we fully invest in our schools in the state, which is now controlled exclusively by Democrats.
I think the larger issue that Alex was raising was this idea of privatizing public education. The union very suspicious that the ultimate goal on the part of the board and the superintendent is to privatize large parts of the district to break it up. There was that story that you were investigating, breaking it up into 32 smaller districts.
Yeah, so I think, you know, I on one hand, I understand the fear of teachers for another restructuring. When I was in the classroom, we had these 7 local districts. Now we have 6. I think we hear a lot of talk about breaking up LA Unified. It is a district that stretches 720 square miles. I actually think we want a lot of the same things as the union, which is reducing the bureaucracy, putting more caring adults on campuses, putting more resources in schools, having community schools, which is something UTLA talks about a lot about. So our idea is that we've been talking about with the community, we've had only over 50 listening sessions, are all about reducing the bureaucracy and putting more resources in schools. There is no secret plot to increase the number of charter schools. Actually, since I've been in office, we haven't opened one new charter school in my district. I do believe that our nonprofit public charters in LA are helping us improve outcomes for kids, but I think we should be learning from them and improving our district schools as opposed to just looking for new options all the time. And that's what this board seems pretty united on.
And the union wants a cap on new charters. Would you be willing to entertain that?
So the charter authorizing laws at the state level. So the district had talked about that years ago. It's illegal. I will say I don't support it in theory. I think parents of any means, you know, wealthy parents who have been choosing private schools for generations, I think poor families should have the option to send their kids to great public schools of whatever type. But that is a state issue. And if the union is going to advocate at the state level, that's on them. But down here, some of the things they're talking about, like transparency and regulation, I wholeheartedly support. I think we have some of the best regulated charters in the state. And actually, the Attorney General of the state issued an opinion last week saying that every district needs to follow the rigorous oversight that we have of charters, you know, the same as if they were government actors.
Let me just ask you this one last question and respond to the survey that was released yesterday that shows that nearly 80% of LA County residents are on the side of the striking teachers. So what is that going to do for your negotiations? What does it do for public support for your board and whether or not you want to seek re-election?
Well, I think we're all on the same side. I've been inspired as tens of thousands of people are taking the streets to support our kids. I hope that this isn't kind of a momentary tweeting and Facebook liking effort, but really when we go to vote for potentially a parcel tax in the LA Unified School District or Prop 13 split roll reform, that these same people will be out there. So I don't see this as a kind of good versus evil, as an us versus them. We're all on the side of kids. If our teachers win, kids win.
But it sure, Nick, it doesn't seem that way. It seems like there are two sides bitterly opposed. You guys are not talking. And there's a lot of contention there. It doesn't seem like you're on the same side at all right now.
You know, unfortunately, Madeline, you're right, I think, at this current moment. But I'm trying to zoom out and hear what I hear from our teachers, what I hear from parents, and what I hear from kids, which is we need to invest in our schools. Kids win when that happens. And I am inspired by teacher activism around the country. I think we want a lot of the same things. We just have to figure out how to pay for it. And so this ultimately becomes a financial issue. And we can agree that when 90% of our budget comes from Sacramento. That's where the advocacy should be from. So yeah. I'm not thinking about this in terms of being criticized or us versus them, even though it feels like that. This is about finding ways to continue to invest in our local public schools.
All right, Nick, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Nick Melvoin, Vice President of the LAUSD Board of Education. Coming up, does smoking weed cause more violent behavior? A new book says, yeah, it does. That's next on Press Play.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. 10 states, including California, have legalized weed. At least two more could soon follow, New Jersey and Illinois. Seems like most people have mellowed out on the supposed dangers of pot. But with what evidence? There's been little research on the health effects, either good or bad. Former New York Times reporter Alex Berenson argues in a new book that the risks could be far greater than we realize. His book is called Tell Your Children, The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. And Alex Berenson joins me now. Hi.
Hi, Madeline. Thanks for having me on.
Great to have you. Well, I mean, I don't want to sound that I'm not taking this seriously, but how is this not the title of your book kind of like Reefer Madness? Like, pot is this dangerous drug that people used to talk about in the 50s, and that's pretty much mocked now. People think pot is benign.
Well, I would disagree with your intro, honestly. There's been a tremendous amount of research done on the mental health consequences of using cannabis. In 2017, the National Academy of Medicine, which is the gold standard for giving health advice in the United States, it's a nonpartisan institute, considered this issue, and they said that using cannabis was likely to increase the risk of developing schizophrenia and other psychoses, and that the more you used, the greater the risk. Now, there are people out there, there's a few people out there who would say that that has not been proven to their satisfaction yet. But the mainstream consensus among the physician scientists who've studied this the most, and they've been studying it for a generation, is that that is correct.
That anybody who smokes weed is more likely to develop psychosis or schizophrenia?
So this gets very complicated. But if... schizophrenia is essentially, one way to look at it is that it's permanent psychosis. Now, it's more complicated than that, but for the purposes of this interview, let's define it as that. Schizophrenia is sort of the most severe form of psychosis you can have. It lasts your whole life. It has terrible consequences. Most people don't work. They don't get married. Schizophrenia is a disabling disorder for most people who have it. If you use, as an adolescent, and you use regularly to heavily, the best evidence is that you have a 2 to 3 times increase in developing schizophrenia. At the same time, and I don't think even advocates for cannabis would disagree, that cannabis can cause paranoia and psychosis temporarily, even in healthy people. People have bad trips. There, you can go online and read, you know, endless stories about people who, you know, who had panic attacks after using, all the way up to psychosis. And so those stories sort of get characterized as kind of a joke. They're not a joke. Psychosis makes people do bad things. So this, I'm not saying, by the way, that everybody's going to have this or even that a majority of people who use are going to have this. That's clearly not true. But enough people are going to have this that it needs to be part of the conversation about legalization.
There's also evidence in this National Academy of Medicine report that there is a statistical association between using cannabis and better cognitive performance with people who have already existing psychotic disorders.
So this gets into what schizophrenia is. Schizophrenia has positive symptoms, which are the hallucinations and delusions. It has negative symptoms. That's like apathy and just inability to function. Mm-hmm. And then it has cognitive symptoms, which are basically IQ and memory. It's possible that cannabis helps with IQ. It's more likely that people who use cannabis and then go on to develop schizophrenia are a different population than people who develop schizophrenia without using it.
But I guess what you're saying, just to reiterate what you said earlier, is that for the average teenager who does not exhibit symptoms of psychosis or schizophrenia, if they are smoking marijuana or taking marijuana in any form regularly or heavily, they have a 2 to 3 times more higher chance of developing schizophrenia. That's I just want to make sure
That's what the best evidence shows. Now, again, that also depends. If you start at 13, it's a lot worse than starting at 18. That is also clear. And by the way, it's not just that you're more likely to develop, you're more likely to develop it younger, and younger development of schizophrenia is very strongly associated with a worse outcome for the disease.
Okay, so aside from people who develop schizophrenia or are prone to mental illness, what is the problem for everyone else for smoking marijuana?
Well, I think there are many people who can use marijuana without becoming schizophrenic or psychotic. There are many people who use alcohol and don't have bad experiences, although we know that on a population basis, alcohol is associated with violence. It's associated with domestic violence. It's associated with bad outcomes when you drive. With marijuana, there's evidence of some of the same problems as well as this tail risk issue of psychosis. I think as much as I am concerned about the real risks here, and they are real and can be severe, I'm even more concerned with the messaging that advocates for cannabis are using, which is this is medicine, this is harmless, this is beneficial. Those things are not supported by good evidence.
But there are all sorts of cases where cancer patients, for example, who are very sickened by, let's say, the effects of chemotherapy, take cannabis and they get their appetite back, or they don't have to take harder pharmaceutical drugs for certain kinds of pain. CBD has been found to help people with epilepsy. There are all sorts
Sure.
of medical benefits.
I would say you've basically gone through what the medical benefits are. CBD is non-intoxicating, and it doesn't seem to have an association with psychosis. For most conditions, it's basically an expensive placebo, and that's fine. We're talking about THC and cannabis that's high in THC and low in CBD, which is what people use to get high. Really, there is very little evidence that those two drugs use anything or treat most of the stuff that it's been speculated that they treat. They appear to help, as you say, nausea associated with chemotherapy. They help pain, but in the long run, it's not clear that they actually do much for chronic pain. There's a really good study that came out from Australia last year that showed that people who had chronic pain, and this covered 1,500 patients for 4 years, those people who used cannabis for their pain wound up actually reporting more pain at the end of the study than the beginning, and they had higher doses of opiates.
You also talk about the increase in violence in various states that have legalized recreational marijuana.
Yes.
And you've made the link between the two. Correlative and not causative? I mean, we don't know exactly what causes violence to increase.
I think people have perhaps deliberately misunderstood the point that I'm making in the book. Before cannabis was legalized, before voters in Colorado and Washington and other states voted to legalize, advocates said crime is going to go down. Police are going to have more time to focus on violent crime like murders. The black market will end. Crime will go down. That is clearly untrue. Crime in the first four states to legalize has risen substantially since 2014. I'm talking about violent crime. I'm talking about murders and aggravated assaults. I am not saying that you can prove that that increase is related to legalization. It is too early to know.
But do you suspect that it might have something to do with marijuana legalization? Because otherwise, why would you put it in the book?
Well, my point is that psychosis is a known risk factor for violence. Cannabis is a known risk factor for psychosis. There are clear cases where people used cannabis over either a short or a long period of time and became violent. I talk about them in the book. So when we're looking at population level data, it's very interesting and striking that the expected decrease in crime in those states, the decrease that advocates promised, has not only not been the case, but that there's been an actual increase.
But the vast majority of people with mental illness do not commit violent crimes at all, are not violent at all.
The vast majority of people with mental illness, defined broadly, that is true. For people with psychosis and untreated schizophrenia, there's an appreciable risk that those people will become violent. That is not to say that most of them are going to do that. They're not. And when people are treated, when they're taking their antipsychotics, they're relatively close in risk to healthy people. But when they are not treated, when they're having their first break, which is, you know, the first time you become psychotic, and especially if they're using drugs, they are at much, much higher risk.
So do you agree with the federal government that marijuana should be a Schedule I drug then?
I guess I don't think it should be a Schedule I drug because I think research should be allowed. I think medical research should be allowed on marijuana. I'm not sure where to schedule it, but the scheduling it at Schedule I doesn't mean that it's as dangerous as heroin. It's not. It just means that there's no medical use. You can use cocaine in a medical setting. You can, doctors actually do still do that sometimes, and even methamphetamine. So that's why those are not Schedule I drugs. There's got to be some better way to talk about marijuana than a Schedule I drug, and we need to figure out what that is.
And what do you say to states and populations who are willing now to legalize it?
Look, legalization is a political question, and whether or not you're going to use the drug, that's your choice. What I want is for there to be an honest discussion of the risks here. And I personally think that legalization is going to, I mean, it's clear, it increases access to the drug, it lowers the cost of the drug, it drives up use of the drug. If you believe that these risks are real, those are probably things we should be talking about before we decide to legalize. I think there's a way to compromise on this. I think decriminalization, where you're not sending anybody to jail for using cannabis, makes a lot of sense. We're not going to put 40 million people in jail for using cannabis. That's how many people used in 2017. But we need to figure out how to talk to people honestly about this.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's Alex Berenson. His new book is called Tell Your Children: The Truth About Marijuana, Mental Illness, and Violence. Coming up, how to use cutting-edge technology to teach medical students about the human body.
Anatomy isn't just about structure, it's about function, and she wanted to work in compassion. So bringing in a different aspect to the anatomy process and understanding, we're trying to understand people, not just their building materials.
A woman tries to achieve digital immortality. Her story next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Susan Potter wanted to donate her body to science after she died, but she didn't want to be a regular old cadaver lying around in an anatomy lab. She wanted to participate in something extraordinary she had heard about in Colorado. It's called the Visible Human Project, and it creates detailed photographs of the entire human body for research and for teaching. Susan would be only the third person to participate. Her body would be frozen at minus 15 degrees, then sliced very, very finely, 27,000 times, and then photographed. And then generations of students could learn from her digital cadaver.
I'm not afraid of death. Death is a healer. Death can be a friend when you're in constant agonizing pain. When you put me on your meat table, you would be shocked because I have railroads running all across my body from my head to my toes. Railroad tracks from surgeries. I really didn't care anymore if I went on one more day. And then the Visible Human came along and I said, maybe God wants me to do another project.
The man behind this project is named Vic Spitzer, and he was with Susan Potter for the last 15 years of her life as she prepared to be immortalized digitally. She died 4 years ago, and their story is now being told in the current issue of National Geographic. Vic Spitzer joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline.
We also have Nat Geo's senior science editor, Kurt Mutchler, in the studio, and he's been following their story for 16 years. Welcome to you, Kurt.
I'm happy to be here.
Great to have you. Dr. Spitzer, let's begin with you. You actually brought this story to Kurt in 2002. How come?
Well, I thought it was very different because of what I agreed to do with Susan, and that is to follow her life for the next 1 year. Her promise was that she was going to be dead in a year. And I said, if you'll allow us to follow your life and your donation wishes, then I will image you like we imaged the visible human. She didn't live up to her end of the bargain. She lasted for 14 more years. But I thought that was very different. And I'm not in the business of documenting someone's life. I just thought it would be a great idea. So I approached the professionals to see if they would be interested. And the professionals that I came to my mind are National Geographic.
So she thought she only had 1 year to live. What were her health problems?
She was in pain most of the time, and a lot of that was from a previous car wreck. She had screws in her cervical spine, but she had many other problems, including diabetes and recovery from melanoma, recovery from breast cancer. Her spine, I now appreciate better when I see the images of it, was a mess. Some scoliosis from aging, but a lot of discs had deteriorated. And she was living with that pain and said it, but she didn't dwell on it. She had a smile on her face most of the time.
So thinking about that, thinking about how damaged her body was, why would she be a perfect candidate for the immortal corpse? And wouldn't you want a pristine corpse?
What we're trying to teach is normal anatomy, not pathology. And Susan Potter was mostly pathology. So it was not in the spirit of the visible human just teaching anatomy. But anatomy isn't just about structure. It's about function. And she wanted to work in compassion. So bringing in a different aspect to the anatomy process and understanding, we're trying to understand people, not just their building materials. So I thought that was an interesting extension of the project. And it was never condoned by the National Library of Medicine. She didn't really become part of the Visible Human Project, but she was treated like that. And we imaged her in the same, or actually much better way, than was done in 1993 with the Visible Human.
Kurt, tell us about Susan's background. She came from Germany. She was born in Germany, and she was in Germany during the Holocaust. She wasn't Jewish, but her parents left her there in Germany as a young girl. They went to the United States. She had a pretty rough childhood?
I would assume so if your parents abandoned you. And I could imagine that as a three-year-old, that you at least at that time couldn't fathom the ramifications of that.
Yeah.
But Susan had a vision, a purpose that she wanted to provide to medical students, and darn if she didn't have the tenacity to pull it off.
So she wanted to spend a lot of time with you, Dr. Spitzer. Do you think that she lived 14 more years basically for this project?
Yes, I do.
You do?
I was told that by other healthcare providers that this was keeping her alive. When we first started all of this, meaning in the first 6 months, she talked to our medical students, and a group of 12 of them after class got together, and I set up a round table for them to talk more with her about the donation process, not so much about her life, but about the fact that she was donating her body, and they were going in and working on other bodies like her. Well, from those 12 students, four of them continued on for their entire 4 years, meeting with her every month or so. They celebrated together. She was at their graduation. I mean, those four students and the attention that they gave her really kept her alive. And I was given credit as her caregiver trying to keep her alive. I am not a caregiver. I am not an MD. I am a PhD. So I wasn't truly giving her care, but I was paying attention to her. And she thrived on that, and she wanted to complete this project. Well, completing the project means dying, but completing the project also was seeing more about her life and following her. All of the information about her period of time during the war and the Holocaust, she refused to ever share with me. I never knew about it until I read it in National Geographic.
But she wanted to have a close relationship with you, from what I understand, reading the article.
she wanted a much closer relationship than I wanted with her. And I tried to convince her I did not want to be her friend. That didn't work. We certainly were friends. She met my family.
But why didn't you want to be her friend?
It's mostly traditional.
But is that really an ethical dilemma?
I'm not sure that it's ethical. It's more emotional. I mean, you don't really want to work on your mother or your father. In the same way, you don't want to section or image or cut up your friend. There's no real logical reason why you shouldn't. If you love your mother and your father and your mother wants to donate her body and help people learn, then you ought to be able to image your own family. But it doesn't work that way emotionally, only logically.
So when she did die and you froze her body, and I'm looking at one of the pictures here, I mean, it's extraordinary. Your hands are in gloves and you're holding this frozen body. It doesn't really even look like a person or a human.
At that point
what was
in time,
what were you thinking of when you looked at her?
I really wasn't thinking anything except doing my job. She doesn't look like a human. She doesn't react like a human. She's frozen, so she doesn't exhibit any human qualities other than her form. And when you're imaging her, there's nothing difficult about it to me, and I think a lot of people I've talked to about it kind of feel the same way. You don't see the humanity of it. It's one reason why we like to convince our students that these really are humans that they're dissecting. They kind of lose the relationship of this human as the dissection continues. One thing that always brings them back to reality is when they see a cadaver that they're dissecting and they uncover their hands and they have nail polish. A cadaver that has nail polish is a real human being. If they don't have nail polish, they're a cadaver. It's rather odd.
So the men don't really get treated that much, unless they do wear nail polish.
Probably
most of the men don't get that same treatment.
That's correct.
So, Kurt, when you were putting this story together, the images are really captivating. What did you want to convey?
It really is ultimately a photographic journey. Lynn set out to capture Susan Potter alive and going about her daily life. And then in color, we would signify her resurrection, if you will, into the virtual space, into the digital world, amazingly from Vic's photography, because as the body was milled each slice at a time, he was photographing it. And it's that compilation of digitized photography, all 27,000 images that make her an anatomical tour de force. And it's why we're talking about her more than 3 years after her death, and probably we'll talk about her forever.
Can you describe, Dr. Spitzer, exactly how this process works, what you're doing when you're slicing this body into 27,000 slices?
It becomes rather graphic. We don't really slice. A slice implies that you have something left that is together and collated. We really grind a thickness of tissue off, and we take a picture of the remainder of the specimen. The specimen, if it's a whole body, you start at the head and you grind off a thickness. For Susan, it was 63 microns. That's a fairly thick human hair. We grind that off and take a picture. You grind off another 63 microns and take another picture of the remainder of the specimen. It's like we're reverse engineering the human body so that you can put it back together and then take it apart again the way you need to or want to in order to research and study the body.
And she knew all of this was going to happen. It sounds very grisly. When I think, would I want that to happen to me? No, thank you. I know. I wouldn't feel it after I'm dead, but still.
She knew it. She shocked me many times, but I think the first time she shocked me was saying, I want to see the freezer where you did this cutting. And I have never been asked that before by anyone. But then again, we haven't done this to only two people before her. But I agreed. She was in her wheelchair, and I wheeled her into the freezer. The freezer wasn't on at that point in time. We only have it on when we're imaging. So it was comfortable in there. And then I showed her the machine where we actually take 63 microns off. And her only comment was, I want a blanket. And meaning not now, but when we're imaging her. And that was her humor. I don't think she meant it, but I also tried to interact with her in a way that tried to be more serious because I like to be humorous too. And I said, no, I can't do that. She also said she wanted roses. And I said, well, I can do that. I can't cut a blanket. It's just too hard to cut. But I said, I'll give you roses.
What do you mean, give her roses?
Two of our anatomy master students painted roses, which I think are gorgeous, on the outside of our freezer door.
And so you finished all of it with her, right? I mean, there's no more work to be done with Susan.
There's no more imaging to be done. There's a lot of work to be done, more work than I will ever do. Any data set like this, the visible human included, we are still working on today in order to bring these virtual bodies back to life. What do I mean by that? Do I want them to live? No. We want that body to act and react like the living. We want to try things out on a body to see how a particular operation will work. Well, you'd need that body to react like a living human. That's the whole goal here, is to make a virtual living human, not a virtual cadaver.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any more visible human candidates waiting?
Well, I do, since this article came out. There's a number of people that have said, I want exactly this. That's difficult. Most of them, in fact, I believe all of them that have said that don't live in Denver. Getting a body soon after death so that it is fresh is difficult. In the original Visible Human Project, we weren't following anybody during their life. We were just trying to accept donors' bodies very quickly after the death, image them with CT and maybe MRI, maybe ultrasound with x-rays, then freeze them, and then section them and image them. So that process has a lot of requirements on speed to the point of freezing, of which Susan was very aware and carried a card in her purse, in fact, a whole stack of them. She would give to people. If she went to the store, she would give those to the people in case she died in that store. They could get her to me, not to healthcare, but to me if she passed away in that store. She wanted to make sure she got into my freezer quickly.
I want to thank you so much for a fascinating discussion.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Vic Spitzer is director of the Center for Human Simulation at the University of Colorado. Kurt Mutchler is a senior science editor for National Geographic, and you can read the story in the latest issue of National Geographic. Coming up, the razor blade company Gillette unveils an ad that urges men to change their behavior. Does it work as an ad? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Is this the best a man can get? That's the opening line of a new online marketing campaign for the razor blade company Gillette. It's a play on their trademark slogan. The ad recreates moments when boys bully other boys, men harass women on the street, and executives in a boardroom act like they own the joint. Gillette is not the only company trying to up its stature by dipping into the cultural zeitgeist. Joining us to talk about this ad is Josh Barrow. He's New York Magazine's business columnist and host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. Hi, Josh.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
Okay, I'm great. So why is a razor blade company lecturing men on how to be woke?
Well, I actually think that's a good question. And I think when you look at this ad compared to the Nike ad with Colin Kaepernick, which I think was a very successful ad, there are a couple of things this ad doesn't do that that one did that are instructive. One is when you go back and look at the Kaepernick ad, it's 2 minutes of amateur and professional athletes fighting against adversity. It's very much in line with Nike's Just Do It slogan, and it places Kaepernick's political activism and the bold choices he made there in line with something that really is in line with the Nike brand image and makes a case for why you would wear Nike. The Gillette ad doesn't really say anything about why you should buy and shave with Gillette razors. Shaving features almost not at all in the ad. It doesn't really make a case about what their product has to do with the message that they're presenting. And then also the message, as you say, it's a case to customers that they should change their ways, certainly at least that they should be doing more to supervise other men and improve their behavior, and at least implicitly that they should be revisiting their own behavior, asking themselves whether they're doing something wrong, which is a perfectly valid and accurate message in general in society. But it's not really a traditional marketing message. It's not designed to make the customer feel good. And in general, the brand works for the customer rather than the other way around. Customers are likely to not take very well to the brand asking them to do something. This, again, is in contrast to the Nike ad, which really places the customer in a position where they can push for positive social change. It's not critical of the customer. It's mm-hmm. telling the customer they can be part of a solution.
Right. Okay. So, but let's posit that women like this, let's say, and they buy the razor blades. Like, I'm just looking at this from the business perspective. I'll get to the cultural part sure. later. But from a business perspective, let's say women are doing the shopping and they're buying the blades and they're like, oh, they see this thing. They're like, yeah, I like Gillette. I feel better about Gillette. I'll buy some Gillette razor blades. So wouldn't it work maybe there?
That's conceivable, but this again gets at a business difference between Gillette and Nike, where I think this doesn't work for Gillette, which is to say Gillette really does need to be everything to everybody. They're already 50% of the razor market in the U.S. Their target customer is anyone who shaves. And so they're a company that really is not in a good position to involve itself in controversy because it can alienate some customers. And even if, as you describe, even if they become very, very appealing to customers, a given person is only going to buy so many razor blades, and there's a 1 in 2 shot that that person was already buying Gillette razor blades. It's a contrast. Mm-hmm. Nike, where someone who develops a very positive image of the brand could buy a lot more shoes, could buy more expensive shoes, could become less price sensitive when they're shopping, buy Nike at any price. You can't really do that as a razor company. You can't develop super fans, and even if you do, they're not going to shave 3 times as much because they like you so much. So the upside from developing that positive image is really limited for a brand like Gillette.
Okay, so let's talk about the reaction. You had Piers Morgan calling it man trashing. But then you also had support from people like Ava DuVernay, who tweeted, "Well done, Gillette." This is obviously bigger than selling razor blades.
Sure. And I mean, I think part of it is we have to remember that companies are run by people. They're not run by robots who are there to figure out what the thing is that will make the brand as much money as possible. Now, that's their goal. They don't come to work and say, I'm here, you know, principally on a social mission. They are there to sell razor blades. But just because a big company like Procter & Gamble that's been very successful does something like this, that doesn't mean that it was the decision's going to make them the most profit. And it doesn't mean that that was the only thing that was on those marketers' minds. So I'm sure people are proud of this campaign. I'm sure that they believe strongly in the message and they have good reasons for believing strongly in that. We're obviously not going to know for some time whether and how much this is affecting sales. I think the thing that saves Gillette here as a business is that Gillette's brand proposition, it's not a lifestyle brand like Nike. People buy Gillette because they think it makes the best razors. And so long as they continue to think that, they may not care very much either way about the messaging that Gillette is sending them. Even if Piers Morgan is writing a column complaining about that, if people think Gillette gives them the closest shave, they'll probably keep buying Gillette.
Yeah. Well, okay. So does it do any harm to have this, really? Because maybe it will convince a few more guys to act less boorishly if they see this thing.
Maybe. I mean, I think, you know, the question, though, is what is the role for the brand to play in society? Obviously, this is a message that there's a good reason people have been talking about for the last year and more than that. Does a brand like Gillette really have moral authority? Are people, you know, they
Well, don't we all have moral authority? I mean, come on, we all participate.
Well, we as people have moral authority, but Gillette's expertise is selling razors. I don't know what, I mean, it certainly doesn't feel to me like people ought to be turning principally to brands for instructions on how to behave morally. And if they, you know, if they were already inclined to agree with the message, then they'll receive it positively. But if they didn't, you know, if they didn't receive this message well when they heard it from women in their lives, when they heard it from famous people, from politicians, from people who are respected in the community, are they really going to respond to it because a razor company said it to them? I generally think when brands do these sorts of you know, these social campaigns. It's more about activating and amplifying their people in their customer base who already agreed with the proposition that the brand is putting out there, rather than changing people's minds. But maybe I'm wrong about that.
Maybe. Well, thanks, Josh. That's Josh Barrow. He's New York Magazine's business columnist and also host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. And that's it for us here at KCRW's Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.